welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 18th of October, 2021, and you're listening to me, Stan Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week in glorious Blighty, and we are here today to discuss the previous week's news, especially the parts of it that are of particular interest to nationalists. And there really is only one thing that we should really be talking about today. And of course, we will be doing that with my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? What's life like over the other side of the country?
Well, life is pretty good. The weather is reasonable for this time of year. And it's a very peaceful and lawful part of the country to live in. Actually, it's a part of the country that because of that aspect of it, it's one of the reasons why I've chosen to live here.
Yeah, same here. Where I am doesn't really have very much multiculturalism. It's a very lawful part of the country to live in, and but of course people that live in the cities, they have to put up with all the dangerous things that we associate with multiculturalism. And of course, the absolute very worst side of multiculturalism was shown just before the weekend when the MP, Sir David Amos, the Conservative Party MP, was stabbed 17 times while he was just carrying out his normal surgery. And I guess maybe listeners that aren't British listeners may not be aware, but our politicians, they regularly go out and they meet the public. They have what is called a surgery, and they do them about once a week or once a month. And they have a place in their constituency where they go, and the members of the public can go up to them and they can talk to them face to face, and they can bring up any issues, and their member of parliament is supposed to bring up these issues for them. It's a fantastic system that we have. It's a wonderful tradition. And it's now being abused. This guy that stabbed David Amos, it has turned out that he's a Somalian, and he's not just any Somalian. He's actually the son of the former communications advisor to the Prime Minister of Somalia. So a fairly well-placed Somalian. You couldn't really say here that he was uneducated or he was living in poverty or anything like that. And his father actually came over to Britain asking for asylum, and we gave him asylum. And his son has just brutally murdered Sir David Amos. And the politician himself, David Amos, I mean, he was just a really nice guy, a nice guy to everyone. Nobody could really have a bad word to say about him. His political views were socially conservative. They included support for the return of capital punishment and Brexit. He was an observant Catholic and he opposed abortion. He had five children. He'd been married since 1983. He was one of 30 conservatives who voted against military action in Syria. And after entering the House of Commons, Amos generally opposed bills furthering LGBT rights, including equal age of consent and same-sex marriage. He was a staunch Brexiteer, and he campaigned for Brexit during the EU referendum, in which he said that it was dangerous and a huge mistake to vote Remain. And in October 2017, following the Harvey Weinstein sexual misconduct allegations, a statement was issued in his name, which described the allegations as dubious to say the least, and quoted Amos as having said that the sudden flurry of alleged inappropriate advances beggars belief. So he seems to me to be really quite a traditional conservative in most aspects. It doesn't mention anything about immigration here, but he was against abortion. He was against LGBT rights, just generally an all round nice guy. Five children. I mean, just it's absolutely terrible that they've lost their father. Another side to this, when he was actually there, while he was dying, the police prevented his priest from giving him the last rites. And we were not told who it was that actually killed him, that the press kept this covered up for most of the day. And because of that, because this is a pattern that we have observed, is that when the attacker is non-white, the press don't tell us who the attacker was. Eventually, it came out that he was, they told us he was a British national, And then they told us that he was of Somalian heritage. So he was a British citizen of Somalian heritage. His father was this very important man in the government of Somalia. And he's just, I just do not understand why he did this. It's just absolutely horrific. That's a rundown of what the situation is. And of course, there's lots of issues that we can get into from that. But I'll pass it over to you, Max, for your thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest thing I think that we can take from this is that we should use this murder as a wake up call. As far as Sir David Amess was concerned, you're quite right that he was in the general sense, he was a very good MP, and he was a good man who had lived a good life and had raised, as you say, a family of, I think it was five daughters, which is commendable, highly commendable there. The one thing, though, that as a Conservative MP that he failed to do, in my view, is that he failed to conserve the one thing that really matters as far as the British people are concerned and as far as this country is concerned, and that is the racial and cultural composition of our people. There doesn't appear to be on record any statements made by him complaining about the uncontrolled immigration that's been pouring into this country. And ironically, there are some memes which are sort of unkindly doing the rounds at the moment where Sir David Amess expresses sympathy with refugees. And I think that other Conservative MPs and other Labour MPs need to look at this situation and to think very seriously about what they're doing in promoting and building multiculturalism in this country, particularly where that multiculturalism is based upon the influx of refugees from other parts of the world, other dangerous war-torn parts of the world. Not all refugees are a danger to our national security or our personal security or our way of life. But when you import people indiscriminately from foreign lands and from the most lawless and war-torn parts of the world, you also coincidentally import a population that are more likely to disagree and who are disproportionately lawless and warlike as a group of people and who are more likely to resort to violence to settle their differences. Somalia isn't a warlike and violent part of the world because of the nature of the trees that grow in Somalia or because of the nature of the soil that you can find in Somalia. Somalia is a violent, war-torn part of the world because of the characteristics of the people that live there, unfortunately, or not all of the people, but of a significant proportion of them, such that they cause the country to have that violent, war-torn character. And as I say, if you indiscriminately import people or allow people to immigrate in as refugees, then you will, by the same token, be increasing the number of people who, as I said earlier on, are more likely to resort to violence to settle their differences. And sadly, this is what we see in the case of Sir David Amess, and MPs need to take note of this and to think upon that. If you think about it, if you go back in time and you think about a time when MPs were local people born and raised in their constituencies, living among and serving their local community that was composed of people just like them, there was no need for security, and attacks upon MPs were virtually unheard of. There was consensus in those days. The views of the MPs coincided with the vast majority of their constituents. Democracy worked, and there was no cause for hatred. When a constituency is composed of disparate groups of people drawn from all over the world and from all the trouble spots of the world, and an MP's constituents are more likely than not nothing like them, there is no consensus, and the views of MPs will no longer coincide with the vast majority of their constituents. Democracy won't work, and the electorate become frustrated, and hatreds arise in that sort of a situation. And that's what MPs of all colours need to think about as far as Britain is concerned, and as far as the the project of trying to turn Britain into a multicultural state. They need to stop that, and they need to put that into reverse, in my view.
Yeah, there'll always be a conflict of interest, won't there? If you have different groups within society, different ethnic groups, they've all got their own interests, and they're not all going to coincide. Each group is going to be competing against the other groups for influence and power. So, and they're going to be helping out their own people. So rather than the country all going in one direction, rather than there being a consensus, there's going to be opposing viewpoints. And although he did speak up and prevent Britain from going into Syria, he did actually support the war in Iraq. So this may have something to do with it. Anjem Chowdhury has pointed out that he was quite big in the Conservative Friends for Israel, or he was the chairman of that. And he was pointing out it may be support for Israel that caused this. We don't know what caused it. We know that the guy that did it was a Muslim. We know that he had been reported to prevent some years back, but he wasn't actually on any watch list. I mean, just the fact that we have this watch list is incredible. We have thousands of people that are on a watch list. And when these attacks happen, we're usually told, well, he was on the government's watch list, as if that is some kind of a consolation that we have to watch these people. And most of the time, it doesn't actually prevent them from carrying out terrorism anyway. And the fact of the matter is, if it hadn't been for the policy of multiculturalism, Sir David Amess would still be here. It would be impossible for him to have been murdered by the son of an asylum seeker. And that's where the irony comes in with his support for refugees, is the fact that he was murdered by the son of one of these refugees. And if there hadn't been that support for the refugees, again, he would still be here. And what do we see happening today? We see this big promotion of Afghan refugees, this big warm welcome for Afghan refugees. And there's been a lot of problems that these Afghan refugees have caused on the continent. Also in America, I believe that there was one terrorist attack that was carried out by one of these Afghan refugees somewhere. So we're really just waiting for the next terrorist attack to happen. This is before you get into the heightened crime rate that you were referring to there, Max. We know that people of African heritage are four times more likely to end up in prison for violent crime. So that essentially means they're four times more likely than white people are, or the indigenous British people are, to carry out crime. So we get this increase in hazard, basically, for all the people that are living in Britain. And the government are aware of this because they're saying we need to provide more security for the MPs. But if even the MPs are not safe, the most important people in the land, if they are not safe, you know, what about the general public? How safe are we? What they need to be doing is looking for something that is going to prevent this from happening, not mitigate the problems, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It's no coincidence, in my view, that when I was a boy, knife crime was a very, very rare occurrence that was virtually unheard of. But now, decades later, after decades of indiscriminate mass immigration, fatal stabbings are almost a daily occurrence and brought about the demise of poor David Amess. And similarly, individuals that are prepared to resort to terrorism are now commonplace amongst our population, whereas they were virtually unheard of when I was a boy. And it is because for decades now, MPs have been ignoring the wishes of the British public and have been hell-bent on creating a multicultural society as quickly as they possibly can.
You know, it was just yesterday that there was somebody caught in London but by the police with a huge sword who was just about to go and attack someone. I mean, every day we hear of stabbings that are going on in these multicultural centres, but particularly London, but in all of these places that are now minority white, that's where the center of all the most violent crime is. And of course, they're trying to deflect attention from this already. Priti Patel is saying that we need to do away with anonymity in social media, and their logic to get to that is to say, well, this is to do with the online discourse, particularly the discourse against MPs. And this is something we pointed out for quite a while, that the left seems to just get away with making all these violent threats against people on the right. I mean, you hear them talking about, Angela Rayner at the Labour Party conference. She was talking about Tory scum. There was a band that were supposed to be playing at Glastonbury, and I believe they had a single that talked about kill the Tories, kill the rich, you know, just calls for violence against people that are on the right. And then we have this narrative that white people are oppressing everybody else. White people are the reason why black people don't do so well. They're the reason why they're not the top directors of businesses. They're the reasons why they don't get the top diplomas in universities. It's all because of racism. So there's this general narrative that white people are to blame for things that whips up this hatred against us, and we just allow it to go on.
That in itself, those complaints themselves are hate speech, aren't they?
Yeah.
And this is what the people who make those kind of complaints don't realise, that they are indulging in the very thing that they're complaining about. It's just that the victim, in each case, is on a different side of the fence.
The other side to this as well, they've been saying, well, we were very worried because of the pandemic that there was going to be a rise in terrorism, and it was predicted because people would have been sat there on Telegram and on the internet instead of going out, and they would have been self-radicalizing. But of course, when they were telling us that, they were telling us it was the far right. They were saying the far right is this huge, huge threat, and there's going to be terror attacks from the far right because during the pandemic people have been online and they've been self-radicalizing themselves, and they're still using those same quotes about people being self-radicalized online, and then they're transferring it to this attack, and they're saying that this attack was somehow to do with that, but I don't know that there's been any link to anything on the internet so far. I don't know that there's been any link to any of these Islamic attacks to what goes on the internet. People that carry out these attacks, they normally have some link to a preacher somewhere or a mosque somewhere. I'm not aware of them being radicalized online. This is a narrative that they push about the so-called far right. And, you know, this is why I think people have to be careful about what they actually say about this, because they will be very keen to turn it against nationalists. If they can find some way to use this against nationalists, they will. And they're talking about removing anonymity. I don't know what that would do anyway. I don't think that's really likely to change people's views. I obviously, I hope they don't do that. I mean, the internet gives people a chance to live the lives that maybe that they would want to live, that they can't actually live in reality. It gives them the chance to be the person that they want to be, that they can't be when they're out in public. Also, if you have anonymity, it's much more likely that people are going to be able to speak the truth. They're really properly going to be able to actually speak their thoughts, so that there are positive points to having anonymity, and I don't think taking away anonymity is going to prevent terrorist attacks. It's not going to prevent violence. It's not going to prevent people that have a short temper threshold from exploding. It's not going to prevent people that want to die for Allah carrying out attacks, or people that want to carry out attacks for a political purpose to do with the Middle East or to do with Islam. It's not going to prevent any of that, and it's not going to lower this discourse either. I mean, just one other side of it that I did think of. We saw this Sir Lindsay Hoyle, the new speaker for the Houses of Parliament. He's been speaking about this because he's doing an investigation into the security of MPs. And each time I see him speak, you know, I just think what a breath of fresh air he is compared to that obnoxious, horrible little man that was in there before him. I forget his name, but he was just so obnoxious, the one that was against Brexit. And I'm just so pleased that he's no longer there. And we have this Sir Lindsay Hoyle. He just seems a really nice guy to me. He's investigating the security of the MPs. I think they're saying that they're not going to let this affect them going to these surgeries. I mean, this is a very long-standing tradition that we have in Britain, that they don't have it in America. You can't go and see your the governor of your state in America face to face, and we can do that here with our politicians. And so they say they're going to continue doing this, but I guess they may have protection. And again, that may cause a problem because somebody may not want to tell their MP, they may not want to say what they have to say to the MP in front of the police or in front of somebody else that's there. So you've got an issue there, I think, which needs
to be looked at. But also, any security measures that are introduced are likely to make seeing your MP more difficult and more protracted. And it will reduce the number of people that can speak to an MP. And so that will damage democracy, in my view. And this is exactly the same thing that we've seen with travel. Instead of the restrictions and the security aspects of international travel now being focused on people who are most likely to be a terrorist, racial stereotyping or whatever it happens to be. Instead of the people that are clearly most likely to be a terrorist being stopped and searched when they're going to fly on an aeroplane, what happens is that people are stopped and searched indiscriminately. And so you have the stupid situation where you have elderly people with their grandchildren going on holiday being searched to see whether there's a bomb in their bag. Well, you know, no grandparent is going to put a bomb in their bag and kill themselves and their grandchildren just in order to make some kind of political protest. You know, those kind of restrictions just simply make going through an airport nowadays an incredibly long and tedious business. And it should be people who are fall within the age group, for example, that are most likely to be terrorists that get stopped and searched. Okay, it's possible there may be older terrorists, and if there are, I'm sure that there is enough police intelligence on older people who are perhaps likely to resort to terrorism, so that the police can individually single those people out and search them more thoroughly. But what we're likely to see now is a situation where fewer people are going to be able to see their MP. This is going to make democracy weaker. And of course, there are various groups in this country who want to see democracy weakened and who want to see democracy fail, and they will be the winners out of this. And really what we need to do as a government is to understand the fundamental reasons why democracy is currently under attack. And, you know, democracy works in a situation where the people who form the constituency of that democracy, where those people are people of similar origins, people of similar social outlook, people who have lived together for generations, for centuries, peacefully, and where the hopes and aspirations of all those people are most likely to coincide, and where any differences, any grievances are likely not to be particularly deep and severe differences and grievances. That's when democracy works. When democracy fails is when you have a population composed of desperate groups of people drawn from all over the world, where there is most likely to be discord between those groups, and where those people come from parts of the world which, as I said earlier on, are the parts of the world where people have disproportionately resorted to violence in order to settle their differences. And that's the thing that our MPs need to realise more than anything else.
Well, it's like these wars that have gone on as well. I mean, you've got people that have come over here that have been told that they're British citizens, and yet Britain, the country that they're supposed to be citizens of, are actually bombing their extended family. You know, when we go to war in Libya, we go to war in Syria, we go to war in Afghanistan, and we've got people of those heritages that are living in Britain. Britain is effectively bombing their family. So, of course, they're going to have a different outlook to us. And that's going to be a very deep difference between outlook, between the way that the indigenous British look at things and the way that Libyans or people of Libyan ethnic heritage are going to be looking at things. I mean, one aspect of this which is a bit of a coincidence, I guess, but just over the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking about these surgeries that the MPs do, and you've got the chance to go and speak to them face to face. And I've been wondering why more of us don't actually use these surgeries. As far far as I'm aware, there was only one nationalist guy that did this a couple of years back, and he said he was really surprised when he got there, because all the people that were actually there to speak to the MP, they were all non-white, and there was nobody white there. And maybe this would be a good form of activism, because what you could do is you could look at your area, you could look at the way that multiculturalism is impacting your area, particularly on white people, and you could make a list up of government policies that have ended up benefiting non-whites and at the expense of white people. And you could then go and you could ask your MP about these things, and you could question him on them. And why have the government done this? And why didn't they take into account the way that this policy was going to affect the white people there? And another thing that you could do is you could make a list of all the advocacy groups, so the various non-whites, so the Muslim advocacy groups, Jewish advocacy groups, black advocacy groups, and you could go to your MP and you could say, well, I notice there are all these advocacy groups that get consulted on government policy to see in which way the government policy is going to affect them. And of course, this is very right. If they're living here, the ways that government policy are going to affect them should be thought about. Where is my group? Where is the advocacy group for my group? Because I've got some issues that I want to take to them. And you could ask the MP this. I mean, we could think up questions that would really put the MPs on the spot, because they have to answer them. And then yes, we could use their answers. Do you think that's a good idea, Max?
I think that's an excellent idea, actually.
Do you know if anybody has actually done anything like that and tried going to their surgeries before in the past? Is that a policy nationalists have had at all?
No, I don't think anybody actually has had that as a policy. So I would say that that would be something that would be a great thing to try. I think what people would need to be prepared for, though, is that they may find that when they go and see their MP, particularly as a result of this killing of Sir David Amis, what we might find now then is that there might be a policeman stood in the corner of the room while you're having your chat with your MP, in which case you need to be very careful about how you word any complaints that you make, because I can imagine that there would be a situation in which a police officer, you know, might arrest somebody who started using language which was inappropriate. So that's something that people would need to take into account. So you would need to be fairly practiced in doing that sort of thing before you set about doing it, or else just be especially careful when you know what words you use when you speak to your MP, even at the expense of putting your argument over feebly initially, if you feel that you're likely to, as a result of the strength of your feeling, to use language that a police officer might take objection to, then you would need to be prepared to put your argument over initially more feebly than you might have wished for, until you get enough practice so that you can actually put over an argument more forcefully, but still with language which is acceptable.
Yeah, you'd have to be very careful that you couldn't be accused of inciting hate. And obviously, it would be difficult if you had a policeman there. I mean, this is one of the ways that it will affect democracy if they have to do that. But then I guess you could carefully write out your questions and then send them to the MP. And because they have to answer the letters as well. If you send them a letter, it has to be answered. We had somebody in one of the PA groups the other day. They wrote to their MP and they asked them about the various effects that importing Afghan refugees might actually have on that area. And the MP did answer back every one of these questions, to show that they had actually thought about these effects, basically. I mean, luckily that area didn't have very many Afghan refugees that were being imported in anyway, but it did put the MP on the spot and they did answer it. So, you know, it's a course of action that people don't really seem to have thought about. So maybe maybe something helpful from this can actually come of this, but by drawing attention to these surgeries and drawing attention to the fact that you should have a direct line to your MP. Do you want to add anything else to that, Max? Is there anything that we should also bring up before we get into our Greatest Britons?
No, I don't think there's anything else that we haven't already spoken about. I think we've covered the subject pretty thoroughly, I think, actually.
Okay, well, let's get into our Greatest Britons for today then, and we'll be talking about Captain Robert Falcon Scott once again. Last episode, we learned about the crew members that Scott picked for the expedition, and we really appreciated Clements Markham's notes on them, pointing out that one was too young to have a bald head, another with a drooping moustache of German heritage, and one who was rather unfledged and lazy, but would be made into a man by the ship's young lieutenants. We heard about how they had to settle for Russian dogs instead of Greenland ones, and how they were left at the London Zoo until they could be shipped to New Zealand. And we discovered that much of the Arctic regions had yet to be mapped, and the adventurers were really heading into completely uncharted territory. Finally, we heard how Ernest Shackleton joined the team, and he was the only one to actually apply for the job. And he had to do that through striking up a friendship with the son of one of the financial backers of the trip. Is there anything else that we should remind listeners of, or anything else you want to add to that, Max?
Well, just that I think we mentioned when we were talking about the, you know, the parts of the approaches to the Arctic and Antarctic not being properly mapped. Well, the Arctic, rather, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? The not being properly mapped. And it just made me sort of think of an uncle of mine who, during the Second World War, served on the ships that were sent round to Archangel in the northern part of Russia to supply the Russians with weaponry, etc. And just his, you know, stories that he told about how freezing cold it was in those conditions, and the clothing that they had to wear, and how grim it was. And so from that perspective, I'm sort of fully prepared to visualize just how cold it's going to be for Scott and the other explorers when they're on this expedition.
Yeah, that Bering Sea is absolutely freezing there. You think about the fishermen that work in the Bering Sea as well. Well, we'll actually find out some more about the vessels that they were in now. The Discovery, that was the ship that they used, was built at Dundee. She was the sixth of her name and the first to be specifically designed and built for scientific work. She had to be a wooden ship to withstand the pressure of the ice, since steel would simply buckle. She also had to be a sailing ship, but with auxiliary engines. The ship was to be exceptionally strong, built from a variety of timbers, English oak for the frames, 11 inches thick, Riga fir for the lining, 11 inches, Honduras mahogany, pitch pine or oak for the 4-inch thick lining, all sheathed with two layers of planking, 26 inches of solid wood in all. Her bow was incredibly strong. Some of the bolts running through the wood were 8.5 feet long. The vessel was 172 foot long and 34 foot wide, of 485 tons register, and a displacement of 1,620 tons. She had to have room to store fuel, oil, 350 tons of coal, fresh water, dog food, medical supplies, scientific instruments, axes and saws, a sectional wooden hut, a piano, and a library. Invitations for bids were offered, but only two were received. On December 14th, 1899, a contract with the Dundee Shipbuilding Company was signed. The keel was laid on March 16th, 1900, and the final cost, including the engines, was £49,277. And that's all quite incredible there, isn't it? They had to build it out of wood. I mean, that's the first thing that surprises me. And then they're actually specifying exactly what type of, what country the wood has to come from. English oak, Riga fir, Honduras mahogany. So there must be subtle differences just between the trees that actually grow in the countries. And the size of those bolts, 8.5 foot. What do you make of the boat, Max?
Yeah, well, it's certainly an impressive vessel, and you know, all the things you've just said about the thickness of the wood, the different characteristics of the wood in order to give it the strength, but also the flexibility, the size of those bolts. You often see old buildings, historic buildings nowadays, where the walls have started to buckle or subside, and where bolts are put through a house from one side to the other, and those bolts can be very long, you know, perhaps 30 or 40 foot long in some cases. So 8 foot long bolts isn't that incredible, but in terms of it being a boat, then they are extremely long bolts, and you can just imagine really the in-depth knowledge that the boat makers would have necessarily had to have had in order to have got all of these details right, so that the boat would have precisely the right characteristics in terms of its buoyancy and in terms of its strength.
Yeah, cost as well, £49,000. That's all. I mean, that would cost millions, I should imagine, to do something like that today. Also, you think of they're taking a piano and a library, and all they would need to bring today is a smartphone, and they would have all the access to the internet on a smartphone. But back then, they have a whole library and a piano, so that they can play the piano, so they've got music, so they can keep their spirits high. You know, very, very important to keep up morale. On March the 21st, 1901, Lady Markham, with a pair of golden scissors, cut the tape, and the Discovery was launched. Food for the 47 men was stored aboard. 150 tons of roast pheasant, 500 of roast turkey, whole roast partridges, jugged hare, duck and green peas, rump steak, wild cherry sauce, celery seed, blackcurrant vinegar, candied orange peel, Stilton, and double Gloucester cheese, 27 gallons of brandy, 27 gallons of whiskey, 60 cases of port, 36 cases of sherry, 28 cases of champagne, lime juice, 1,800 pounds of tobacco, pemmican, raisins, chocolate, and onion powder. And I'll just stop there. I mean, look, think of all that alcohol. I mean, I don't know if they allow alcohol on the space station. I guess that's the only thing you could probably compare to it today. But I think that would be very different today, the supplies that they were bringing with them. Don't you think, Max?
Well, sailors in times gone by, particularly those that were sailors of warships, were given a very considerable ration of alcohol each day, which I've always assumed was so that they would be in a fighting spirit when they encountered the enemy. And but certainly from that list of things there, with the cheeses and the orange peel and the cherry sauce and the jugged hares and the duck and everything else, you know, they certainly were intent on eating well. And it reminds me actually of the, I mean, when you were going through the all of the money that they would need to raise, etc., just reminded me of a previous Greatest Britain that we've had, which was Sir Ranulph Fiennes, and the fact that you know, firstly he had to go through in meticulous detail composing a list of all the things that they would need for the trip that the trips that he organized, but also the fact that I'm pretty sure it was his group that one of his expeditions where they invented the idea. I'm not quite sure what they called it now from memory, but wasn't it something like rum o'clock or something like that, where they all had a daily ration of rum in order to keep their spirits high?
Yeah, that was it. It was called rum o'clock. I should imagine that they were probably thinking, but it's going to warm them up as well, and a little treat at the end of the day to have a top of brandy or whiskey. But it just seems like quite a lot there, doesn't it? 27 gallons. And then, of course, the champagne, 28 cases of champagne. I should imagine that would have been for celebrating being the first to discover something. And then you've also got to think about Christmas, because they're going to be spending Christmas there as well. They're going to be wanting to celebrate that. While being loaded, many visitors came to see her. Among them were two former colleagues of Sir James Clark Ross, Sir Erasmus Ommaney, now aged 87, who had sailed with Ross to the Arctic in 1835, and the famous botanist Sir Joseph Hooker, the naturalist in James Clark Ross's Erebus and Terror expedition. It was upon Hooker's advice that Scott found £1,300 to purchase a balloon for the voyage. With much fanfare and a Godspeed service on board, the Discovery weighed anchor on July 31st, 1901, pausing at Spithead to correct her compasses, and proceeded to Cowes to receive the royal blessing. The new king and queen, still uncrowned, came aboard. The queen's Pekingese actually fell overboard, and one of the sailors had to rescue it. The next day, August the 6th, the Discovery passed the Needles on her way to the unknown. As Markham noted, truly they form the vanguard of England's chivalry. No finer set of men ever left these shores, nor were men ever led by a finer captain. And that that really reminds me of the stuff that was sort of written during the Crusades, and just this idea of chivalry and England's finest men, and they used to be knights, and now they're adventurers, and you got the king and the queen that are going on board as well in order to give it their blessing. It's a real sort of family affair, isn't it? Back when, you know, when we were still an extended
halcyon
family.
Days, as they call them.
Yeah, definitely halcyon days. Well, the Discovery was so heavy in the seas that she could not make more than 7 knots, and this became an immediate concern as New Zealand was 14,000 miles away. Her first stop was at Madeira Island, where they took on more coal and sent back considerable mail. But after leaving Madeira, the men were shocked to find that the Discovery was leaking water into the hold, and as a result had ruined a significant amount of the food. What could be dried was saved, but the rest was thrown overboard. The ship arrived in Cape Town on October the 3rd, 1901, where nearly everyone proceeded to get drunk. Owing to the slowness of the voyage, Scott decided to cut the Melbourne leg out of the journey and sail directly to Lyttelton, New Zealand. As a result of this decision, Dr. Murray was left in Cape Town so that he could return to his post at the British Museum. The Discovery arrived at Lyttelton at the end of November, where the leak at last received attention. Meanwhile, the hospitality extended to the crew was generous, at the very least. Royds wrote that there was not a single sober man on board. The men are rushed at as soon as they get ashore, and all good service feeling is lost, and I have awful times. Better men never stepped a plank whilst they are at sea, but in harbour they are nothing but brute beasts, and I am ashamed of them, and told them so, and penitent indeed they are, but only until they are drunk again. Scott wrote that the drunken men disgust me, but I'm going to have it out with them somehow. There are only a few black sheep, but they lend colour to the flock. A few were discharged and replaced. The men were nearly all bachelors, and the young sailors soon were welcomed right into New Zealand homes. Skelton lived with the Mears family and eventually married the youngest daughter, Sybil, while Ferrar went on to meet his future wife in Christchurch. So sailors don't change, do they? Even when they're ferrying scientists to the Antarctic, they are they're still going to get drunk once they get to the shore. And I think we can see here in Scott, because he missed out on that going out and enjoying with his friends, because all his money was being sent back home to his mother to fund his mother once his father died. So he missed out on that going out with all his comrades while he was working his way up in the Navy. So he doesn't really understand the need to go out and have fun. So he's disgusted at it. And I like his turn of phrase here. There are only a few black sheep, but they lend colour to the flock. I've heard of the black sheep before, but I haven't heard it put there that they would lend colour to the flock as well. While in New Zealand, Scott was to receive some good news from Markham. The men had determined that a relief ship would be needed to resupply the Discovery the following year and, of course, check on their condition. In May 1901, Mr. Llewellyn Longstaff contributed £5,000, which Markham used to purchase the Morgannon. In September, she sailed from Norway to England, where she was refitted and renamed the Morning. Lieutenant William Colbeck, RNR, was appointed her commander. Colbeck had Antarctic experience, as he had been the magnetic observer on Borch Grevink's Southern Cross expedition. On December the 21st, the Discovery was escorted by HMS Ringarooma and HMS Lizard out of the harbour as cheering crowds stood on the shore, waving farewell. And this ship, the Morning, this second ship, really proved very, very useful with transferring mail, bringing mail to them and taking mail back once a year. And it will play quite an important role as we make our way on through the story. Is there anything you want to pick up on there or add to it, Max?
I think the observations you made about Scott not appreciating the drunkenness of his men. But I think that in any situation where people, where you know, a group of men are going into a very harsh environment and going into a very dangerous kind of adventure, then that there is a lot of bonding that takes place as a result of the laughs and the jokes that the men have together. That helps to hone them into a team where they look after each other and they're prepared to sacrifice and make the ultimate sacrifice for the safety of the others in the most extreme cases. And so, you know, that's something which is sort of fairly easily understood from the point of view of looking back with hindsight at what took place there.
Yeah, and Scott didn't quite understand it. That was the bit that had been missing from his sort of naval education. I also find it interesting that two of them then got married as well. You know, these young bachelors. I mean, they would have had a lot of fame for going on this expedition. And this is the way that it was back then. You would meet a woman and you would you would get married. There wasn't much of this dating that goes on today, trying out different partners. It was you meet somebody, you fall in love, and you would propose, and you would get married straight away. Usually at quite a young age. Well, soon after crossing the Antarctic Circle, they entered the ice pack. Just before midnight on January the 8th, 1902, Royds sighted land off the port bow. They headed for Cape Adare, where Borch Grevink's party had wintered and soon landed on the beach. From Cape Adare, they sailed nearly due south along the shore of Victoria Land and eventually landed at Cape Crozier on the northeastern tip of Ross Island, where Royds and Wilson climbed to 1,350 feet and viewed the great ice barrier, stretching as far as the eye could see. From Cape Crozier, they steamed along the eastern edge of the barrier, and on January 30th, after emerging from a whiteout in a snowstorm, the eastern extremity of the barrier was reached, where patches of rock were determined to rise 2,000 feet above them. Scott named the new discovery King Edward VII Land. Scott turned about and retraced their route back to McMurdo Sound, where they intended to set up winter quarters. Along the way, they stopped long enough for Scott and Shackleton to take a trip aloft in the balloon, but the balloon developed a leak and was never used again. I was wondering what the balloon was going to be used for. Yeah, so they could get a view from up high of what the landscape was like. Yeah, that was a good idea. I was thinking maybe they were going to use it for emergency purposes or something.
It must have occurred to them that this was almost like going to a different planet. You know, the landscape, the topography of the land and the thickness of the ice, etc., must have just appeared absolutely fantastic to them. And it must have been, you know, really quite a thrilling thing to take part in.
Oh, definitely. No trees, no animals, completely alien landscape that most people have never seen before. After arriving at their winter quarters, the ship was secured by ice anchors to an ice foot, and a 36-foot square hut was built. Two smaller huts were put up to house the magnetic instruments, and the dogs were moved into their kennels. On February 16th, 1902, the sun slipped below the horizon for the first time. It was too late in the season for any long-distance sledge trips, so Scott planned a few short practice trips to test the equipment and the men. As it turned out, Armitage and Bonacci were the only men with a little dog-driving experience. It was hilarious to watch them, but many hard lessons were learned. The first trip was a three-day affair to White Island by Wilson, Shackleton and Ferrar. A hard lesson was learned on this first sledge trip, as the three nearly became the first casualties of the expedition. Distances in the Antarctic are very deceptive, and when plans were made, the three felt the island could easily be reached in a day and a half of sledging, and the men had decided to haul the sledge themselves. It was 2 days before they reached the island, whereupon a blizzard set in and frostbite struck their faces and feet. They were so exhausted from the trip that they could hardly pitch their tent and cook their meal. This trip taught them how little they actually knew about the Antarctic.
Wow.
The next trip was taken by 4 officers and 8 men with 4 sledges, leader Royds, Quartley, Vince, Weller, Wild, Barnes, Skelton, Evans, Heald, Plumley, Cutlets and Hare. On the morning of March the 4th, the men started out for the Penguin Rookery at Cape Crozier, where they were to leave a canister containing directions on how to find the expedition's winter quarters. Scott was to lead the party, but he had to decline as he had injured his knee in a skiing accident. The dogs did hardly anything but fight. Frostbite attacked. The snow was so soft that they sank in well above their ankles, and progress was so slow that on the second day they had only made 5 miles. The rations got mixed up in the bag, so that a mash of sugar, cheese, butter, soup tablets and chocolate had to all be cooked together. Most of the dogs went lame, and the men were exhausted. So on the fourth day, Royds decided to push ahead with Cutlets and Skelton and send the rest under the leadership of Barnes back to the ship. Royds and his men had a terrible struggle, and after 5 days of hard going, they still hadn't found the rookery. Royds decided to give up on the search and return to the ship as temperatures reached minus 42 degrees Fahrenheit. Wow. And I'm wondering if they're doing all this in the dark, if the sun has gone down for the first time. Do they mean that's gone down for the first time in the winter and in that Antarctic it won't come back up again until 6 months time or 5 months time, or were they meaning
I think it's just I think there would down? Be a gradual progression of right. The darkness expanding to eventually so that in the darkest part of the winter it would be permanent darkness, so it would be a gradual thing, I would think.
And interesting that they're trying to pull the sledges themselves rather than using the dogs. A lot of things are starting to go wrong already. Roy's Cutlets and Skelton reached the hut in 4 days, but the other men had not been so lucky. Barnes and the returning party, 8 members in all, had arrived to within 4 miles of the ship at a hill called Castle Rock. When they reached the summit, a blizzard came up and reduced visibility to nearly nil. They pitched their tents, and since they couldn't get their cookers to work, frostbite began to set in. An experienced crew would have remained, no matter how uncomfortable, but the novice crew decided to head out into the storm. They soon found themselves on a steep, slippery slope where Evans stepped on a patch of bare ice and tumbled out of sight. Barnes sat down and slid after him, with Quartley following close behind. All 3 men miraculously came to a halt when a patch of soft snow stopped them right at the edge of a precipice with the sea pounding below. A howling dog flashed past and disappeared over the edge. Frank Wild took charge of leading the remaining 5 who were left at the head of the slope. He led them off in the direction of the ship, but suddenly came upon a cliff with the dark sea below. Another step and he would have gone right over the edge. Unfortunately, Vince could get no grip on the slippery ice, and like the dog, he vanished over the edge and into the sea. Wild, Weller, Heald and Plumley were able to fight their way back to the ship. Of the original 12, only 4 had returned. A search party was quickly organised and led by Wild, who came upon Barn, Evans and Quartley wandering about in a daze at Castle Rock. That evening, Royds brought in his party, and so it seemed only 2 men were lost, Vince and Clarence Hare. Hare had last been seen heading back to the abandoned sledges to get his ski boots. 2 days later, a figure came walking down the hill towards the ship. Incredibly, it was Hare, and without even a trace of frostbite. It seems he had fallen down and simply gone to sleep. The snow covered and preserved him as he slept for 36 hours. That is quite incredible, isn't it?
That's amazing.
36 hours sleep under there. Well, I guess they do live, the Eskimos, they live in the igloos, don't they? And the snow is like an insulator. Even though it's 0 degrees, it is an insulator, and it will keep the wind off you, and it will keep the really freezing cold off you as well. Well, they've already lost 2 people. It's a dangerous expedition. basically. And you imagine you're freezing cold the whole time as well. One more sledging trip was undertaken before winter set in. On Easter Monday, Scott started off with Armitage, Wilson, Ferrar and 8 men with 3 sledges and 9 dogs. The objective was to lay depots towards the south for the use of the sledging parties in the spring. So I guess what they would do is they would go out sort of half the distance that they know that they could go, lay the depot, and then come back to base again. So they knew that they had food stashes along the way so that they could actually go further the next time. So that's what they're doing here. The dogs refused to work and the temperature dropped to minus 47 degrees Fahrenheit. When they became exhausted, the men crawled into their sleeping bags. As Wilson put it, once in, one can do literally nothing but lie as one falls in the tent. Reindeer skin hairs get in your mouth and nose, and you can't lift a hand to get them out. At night, the men would sweat, which would produce a puddle beneath them. And since nothing could be dried, by morning you put on frozen mitts and frozen boots stuffed with frozen grass and rime. There's a fascination about it all, but it can't be considered comfort. 2 more days of this and Scott decided enough was enough. They packed up their gear and headed back to the ship, with everyone learning from this experience. On April 23rd, 1901, the sun sank below the horizon and would not reappear for more than 4 months. There we go. So that's when the sun actually went down. You know, we forget about all the technology we have today, just camping technology, you know, sleeping bags. I mean, that's just a fantastic piece of technology that they never had years ago. You know, they're just under that's these... Right. Reindeer
pelts. Things they pull themselves into a sleeping bag while they were standing and then just flop over on their side.
completely worn out from the day. A winter routine was established with each man having his own special task. Royds was in charge of the seamen and petty officers who were employed on routine activities such as watering ship every few days by hacking out blocks of ice and taking them on board to be melted in the boiler. Exercise was a problem, as blizzards and extreme cold kept everybody inside for days on end. Birthdays were celebrated by special dinners, and a religious service was held each Sunday. The South Polar Times appeared, edited by Shackleton, and all were invited to contribute. The first copy was formally presented to Captain Scott. Some men played cards and chess, while others read and carried out scientific studies. So I guess for the whole of this 4 months, they really kind of gone out and done many of these scientific expeditions, and they're all just having to get on together inside the hut.
But acclimatizing would be a very, very important thing to do in that situation.
Yeah, and I guess also you have the time to do your writing here and write your journal, and they've got the South Polar Times, which I guess must be a sort of newspaper that they worked out that they were going to write, keep track of things that then could be used when they got back, or be sent on the mail vessel when it got there. Yes. Summer sledging began on September the 2nd when Scott and 8 others set out to lay a depot. They were back in 3 days as the conditions were impossible for both men and dogs. A typical sledging camp can best be described from descriptions written in the diaries of the men who fought the extremes. The first step was to set up a small tent just large enough for 3 men to lie down in. Snow was piled up around the outside of the tent in order to hold it down in case of a blizzard. The sledge would be unloaded and the cooker set up inside the tent. One had to be careful when grabbing metal as sometimes your skin would stick right to it. Changing from the day outfit into night gear was a laborious task indeed. First, you removed your finnescoes, making sure you left them in the shape of your feet, since they froze as hard as bricks in a few minutes and would be impossible to put on in the morning until one could find a way to thaw them out. Then you had to unlace your leggings, which had to be done with bare hands. Needless to say, a pause was necessary periodically to stuff your hands back in your pants to keep them from frostbite. 3 pairs of socks were pulled on, which had been kept next to the body all day in order to keep them warm. Then came a long pair of fur boots reaching above the knee, then fur trousers, And finally, a loose fur blouse. Day socks were often tucked inside the pant leggings in order to keep them warm for the next morning. Then came supper, which consisted of a hoosh made of pemmican cheese, oatmeal, pea flour, and bacon. At bedtime, it was often discussed whether each man should sleep in his own bag or if three should try it together. When it's minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, it is certainly much easier to keep warm with three in a bag. Unfortunately, one could not move without disturbing the others, not to mention the fit of experiencing a leg cramp, which they often did. Condensation of breath was another problem. After a few days, the inside of the tent became covered with a layer of ice, and every time the wind shook it, a shower of ice fell on the men sleeping beneath. Also, their breath froze in their beards and around the necks of their fur coats, which produced a collar as stiff as a board. Shivering fits could last for hours. I should imagine it would have been very difficult as well with the sweating as well. If you've got three of you there inside a sleeping bag and you've got ice that forms underneath you, or the, you know, puddles from the sweat, it's a very difficult situation. Just trying to get to sleep. The next morning it got even difficult. Even more difficult, the whole process would be repeated in reverse. Then Bernacchi wrote, 25 years later, came a ceremony that no one ever talks about. Bathrooms were ruled out since they took too long to dig, and besides, they would just fill up with snow. So feeling like a ham in a sack, each man took his turn loosening his clothes, going out into the snow, facing the wind, and watchfully awaiting a temporary lull. It's a ghastly business. No matter how quick you were, your clothes would fill with snow, and for the next few hours you would walk around with a wet, cold bottom. Some of the men... Not good. Not good. Some of the men suffered from dysentery, so one can easily imagine how much misery these men had to sustain when blizzards raged for days on end. And I think we'll leave that there for this week. But I mean, this really gives us an idea of how difficult life was for them, and they're going to be like this for years.
You can't imagine many people of today being prepared to tolerate that. Crikey.
And not thinking that, you know, I'm desperate to get out to the Antarctic so that I've got the freedom to properly discover what I'm capable of. I mean, that was Scott's reason for wanting to go out there. He wanted the freedom to really be tested on what he was capable of. And this is why he pointed out that this was going to make men out of the young fledglings that they had on board. And this big test of endurance and having to get on with everyone. Well, as I say, well, I think we'll leave that there then, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
That's okay. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.